And we were thinking about the textbook 6th edition, weren't we? And let's just note how this was accompanied by certain organizational developments in the movement aimed at the self-propagation of Christian Science, because this is what relates this edition with what happens in the third day of creation, where the earth is bringing forth, propagating, and reproducing itself from within its own being. So we do see the correlation there, don't we? Well, it wasn't until the book's 16th edition was published in 1886 that the text underwent its third major revision, relating its evolution at this point with the fourth day of creation, the day that features the whole stellar cosmos. Because here, two new chapters were added to the key to the scriptures, which before it consisted of the glossary only. And these were the chapters Genesis and the Apocalypse. Genesis included the first and second accounts of creation, lifted from the chapter called Creation, while the Apocalypse consisted of a treatise on Revelation 12 only. That is, except for an opening section from Revelation 10, where the angel brings the little book Science and Health from heaven. So the chapter was really all about the God-crowned woman herself and her battle with the great red dragon. No reference was made at this stage to the Holy Mother City of Revelation 21 that was to come later. But included, however, was another new so-called supplementary chapter titled Wayside Hints, in which the Holy City was indeed hinted at as being on the way. And another significant feature, a chapter called Prayer and Atonement, and we must watch this carefully, was taken from the main body of the book and placed in between Genesis and the Apocalypse in the key to the scriptures. Now, what could be the reason for this? Because the chapter itself had so little bearing on the key to the scriptures. It could only surely be that prayer was in effect being offered at this point for the at-one-ment of Genesis and the Apocalypse, a union that would be ratified in the next revision, when the Holy City itself would be added to the Apocalypse, and Revelation 12 and Revelation 21 would comprise one continuous text. Prayer and Atonement would then be restored to its original place in the main body of the book. Because this inclusion of the city foursquare would signify then that Genesis and the Apocalypse were indeed united in holy wedlock, as pointing to the marriage of the manhood and womanhood of God, that is, of the Lamb and his bride, to use the imagery that we find in the book of Revelation. Well, this was the textbook throughout its fourth evolutionary phase, that is, until 1891, when the next big revision appeared, deemed to be the most auspicious and extensive of all the revisions. And it came at the point of the book's 50th edition and corresponded in the development as a whole to the fifth day of creation in the 5,000-year period when Jesus and the Christian era appeared. Now, the text, generally speaking, was at this point extensively reworked, so much so that in the main it stayed largely in this form until finally the book was finished in 1910. Now, in this celebrated 50th edition, a new chapter, Science, Theology, Medicine, recounting the original 1866 revelation, was added and placed to become the book's opening chapter. It contained for the first time the statement of what we know today as the two phases of scientific translation. Scientific translation of immortal mind, you remember, followed by scientific translation of mortal mind, though this was called originally scientific definition of immortal mind and scientific definition of mortal mind. But the chapter also included for the first time that supremely important statement that divine metaphysics is now reduced to a system, in a form comprehensible by and adapted to the thought of the age in which we live. Now, apparently Mrs. Eddy had told the students very early on that what she was engaged in doing was reducing her original discovery to the form of a comprehensible system of ideas. And now, at the point of the textbook's fifth evolutionary phase, this reduction had evidently been accomplished. How natural and how significant, therefore, that in this 50th edition, a range of capitalized synonymous terms for the one infinite Godhead should be used also for the first time in the chapter recapitulation to answer the question, what is God? Now, incidentally, recapitulation was a chapter that was added to the textbook in the third edition of 1881 as being the revised form of a pamphlet called Science of Man, Questions and Answers on Moral Science, compiled prior to 1875 and becoming the basis later of the textbook itself. Well, with this inclusion of an order of synonymous terms to answer the question, what is God? It was now said of the chapter as a whole that absolute Christian science pervaded its statements, whereas before this had been the theology of Christian science. Now, can we see the wonderful logic in that? Because what we have to realize, of course, is that from the first edition of 1875 onwards, the book had always teemed with different synonymous terms for the one absolute God. Mrs. Eddy, in other words, had from the beginning realized the necessity for a differentiation of concepts of God in order to ensure an integrated spiritual understanding of God. In fact, it was in 1888, in the course of the book's fourth evolutionary phase, that she's on record as telling a class of students that upon the truth of these terms for God rests the whole structure of Christian science. Or another version, upon the truth of these terms for God rests the basis of the science. In fact, they are the science. Now that's in the compilation called Miscellaneous Documents, and it's on pages 61 and 84. And my goodness, how we shall have occasion to remember those words when we merge from our present preoccupation with the founding mission itself in the left-hand wing of the triptych and move to the right-hand wing, or to the story of what transpired regarding the science and system of her discovery when the founding mission had fulfilled itself. So we couldn't doubt, could we, the enormous importance of the time when the 50th edition was published in 1891, and when perhaps the most outstanding feature of all was the addition of Revelation 21, the treatise on the holy four-square city, to the chapter The Apocalypse, as the immediate follow-on from Revelation 12, where the chapter had previously ended. And do make sure you see how this marks the beginnings of the fifth evolutionary phase of the mission as a whole, and how it corresponds, therefore, with the fifth day of creation and the fifth thousand-year period. In other words, just look across for a moment at what is going on at this point in the main center panel. Because the change that is now taking place in Mrs. Eddy's founding career is as momentous as the change that takes place in the center panel itself when the Old Testament yields to the New Testament and the Christian era, starting with the life work of Jesus, is launched. And this will all have even greater significance when we come in a moment to the story, not of the textbook, but of the founding of the church organization, which directly complements the textbook. But let's first conclude our survey of the evolution of science and health, where this fifth phase continues until the year 1902, close to the turn of the century, when another outstanding revision takes place, and which corresponds, self-evidently, with the sixth day of creation, the day of man himself, the image and likeness of God, who has dominion over all the earth. Because this is the moment when the order of the chapters in the book as a whole is completely changed to make it, as a textbook, commensurate with the spiritual needs of generic man, or the human race itself, the reality of which is man in the sixth day of creation. So it wasn't the text as such that was overhauled at this point. This, as we've said, had largely been done in the 50th edition of 1891. What came now was the final change to the order of the chapters. You see, from the fifth phase to the sixth phase, the book had opened with science, theology, medicine, pointing, as we would expect, to Mrs. Eddy's own individual revelatory experience, for which she said that over many years God had been graciously preparing her. But this would not meet the need of collective and universal humanity, which likewise would have to be divinely prepared before pure revelation based on direct union with God could dawn, as in the case of Mrs. Eddy. Accordingly, science, theology, medicine was moved from being the opening chapter to being the sixth chapter in the new order. The five chapters that preceded it, starting with prayer and ending with animal magnetism unmasked. Because these five chapters represent to the student his own spiritual preparation, before he too can be at the place where Mrs. Eddy was in 1866, when the gift of the grace of God came to her directly as the revelation of pure Christian science, there being no mortal persona, no animal magnetism, masking the truth of man's immediate at-one-ment with the divine principle God. Because just note how in the dictionary the word person or persona has the same root meaning as the word mask. Persona, per sonare, meaning to sound through. See, Mrs. Eddy, like Jesus before her, had proved that she was not a mortal personality through which divine truth sounded, but rather that she was the pure revelation of truth itself coming direct from its divine source. So it has to be in the case of all of us, hasn't it? Hence the necessity for the fifth chapter to unmask this sense of our being egotistical, mediatorial personas or personal sounding boards for God. Because if we were personal sounding boards for truth one moment, we might just as easily become personal sounding boards for error the next. And so the new order of the chapters that appeared in 1902 conformed the book as a whole to the needs of humanity, making it possible, therefore, to add for the first time the final 18th chapter fruitage, which is the student's own healing response, his own spiritual feedback, if you like, for all that the book has taught him and has done for him. You see, the wonderful thing is that at the turn of the century, in 1901, 1 year before this revision of the textbook was published, Mrs. Eddy had declared to the world, through the world's own press, that when she herself was no longer personally present, her successor in leadership would be not another individual like herself, but man in the image and likeness of the Father, Mother, God, man, the generic term for mankind, That's Miscellany 347, as I'm sure we know. The man that is of the sixth day of creation. And now we can begin to see, can we, how the 1902 edition of the textbook made this succession possible. Follow your leader only so far as she follows Christ, Mrs. Eddy had always bidden her students. Can we see, therefore, that if Mary Baker Eddy herself typifies the woman in the Apocalypse, the God-crowned woman of Revelation 12, whom she declares to be the symbol of generic man, the spiritual idea of God, and this woman is so one with God that she's no other I, no other ego or self, but the divine principle love, that it's really the divine principle love and not a human personality, however auspicious, that is the continuous and forever mother and leader of the Christian Science movement. So that when, in 1901, the year also of the writing of the poem The New Century, in which she refers to the 20th century as being God-crowned, the implication is that this is the century of the woman, generic man, and therefore of the man of the sixth day of creation. Can we see, therefore, how it is that if Mrs. Eddy's successor in leadership is man, the generic term for mankind, that there's no real change in the leadership from the founding phase of Christian Science to the phase that comes after it. The divine principle love, in other words, is the only original and ultimate leader, the only original and ultimate mother, whose continuity is never in truth interrupted by any kind of personal leadership, requiring thereafter a personal apostolic succession of leaders. Now, incidentally, the edition of 1902 that brought these changes to the order of the chapters and caused the book itself to apply to the man of the sixth day of creation was the 226th edition, and its structure remains substantially the same until the final, completely fulfilled edition of 1910. And we come, therefore, to the period from 1907 to 1910, marking the seventh and last period of the mission as a whole that corresponds to the seventh and final day of creation, and therefore to the seventh millennium itself. And in anticipation of this consummate last period, Mrs. Eddy in 1906 applies for her final copyright on the Christian Science textbook, an application that comes into effect later in 1907. Also in 1906, she ceases to number the editions. What's being represented ideally, you see, is that from 1907 onwards, the book is truly in what is called the public domain, is being restored, that is, to the motherhood of the divine principle love, its original source and fundamental author. Now, I think there's a very helpful little story of when one of Mrs. Eddy's secretaries saw that he had to be very clear, very careful about his relationship with her. So he prayed and prayed about it, and the answer came. When I am in her presence, he saw, I have to remember that I am in the presence of the author of science and health. Well, who then was the author of science and health? Because you remember how she herself once wrote of how she would blush to write of science and health with key to the scriptures, as I have, were I apart from God its author. So how many authors were there then? God and Mary Baker Eddy? No, only one. And this one, the divine and the human, one in coincidence. So she could say of herself, couldn't she, that she was a scribe under orders. Well, this apparently satisfied the secretary, and I find it very helpful too, don't you? Now, as far as the book is concerned, that which marks outstandingly its seventh and last evolutionary phase, corresponding with the seventh day of creation, when what it reveals regarding the true idea of God can be said to be finished, is the finalizing in one of the 1907 editions of the answer to the question, what is God? Now, this answer had appeared in many different forms over the years, but the ultimate rendering, denoting the absolute fundamental of the science and system of pure Christian science, did not come until 1907, when it read as we have it today and forever, God is incorporeal, divine, supreme, infinite, mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love. You see, what else could enable the admonition to be added in 1908? Christian scientists, be a law to yourselves that mental malpractice cannot harm you either when asleep or when awake. Surely nothing but the understanding of what God is in absolute science enables us to be a law to ourselves in this way, at both the unconscious and conscious levels of thought, or when asleep or awake. Don't you agree? And what else, when we think about it, would cause also in 1908 the form of the crown and the Christian Science seal of the cross and crown to be changed from being an imperial crown to a circle of 12 seven-pointed stars, such as adorns the head of the woman in Revelation 12, who symbolizes generic man? That isn't too much to conclude, is it, that at this point Mary Baker Eddy's successor in leadership is, in effect, crowned? And then the very last textual change that takes place in 1909, where previously the statement had read, the truth of being is perennial and the error is seen only when we look from wrong points of observation. This was changed to, The truth of being is perennial, and the error is unreal and obsolete. The error in question being shown in the paragraph's marginal heading to be mortal birth and death. Yes, indeed, when we look at humanity from the right, the divine point of observation of the synonymous terms for God finalized in 1907, the entire mortal birth-death cycle is necessarily rendered unreal and obsolete. Now please hold this well in thought when we come to consider what is happening in the church organization at this point, or when we pursue the church's development down the second column of the triptych's left-hand wing, as we've now pursued the progress of the textbook down the first column. But finally, to fulfill the text of Science and Health, changes had to be made to two of the chapter titles. This in 1910. Then the book was truly finished. You see, instead of Christian Science and Spiritualism remaining the title of the fourth chapter, this was changed to Christian Science versus Spiritualism, making Christian Science and Spiritualism not two separate antagonistic factors, but Spiritualism being but the suppositional reverse in world consciousness of what is actually ever-present Christian Science itself. Because in this case, animal magnetism in the fifth chapter is properly and finally unmasked, instead of the title being left simply as animal magnetism, whereby the impression might be given that animal magnetism was an actual entity, some fearsome old bogeyman that actually needed to be destroyed. But there we have it then, at least in outline, the textbook. So should we turn our attention now to the evolution of the church in the second column under the heading of church and college. You see it there? As that which, as far as the founding mission as a whole is concerned, is the precise, indispensable complement of all that the textbook stands for in the first column. And let's note that in the textbook's first edition, published in 1875, there's no thought whatever of the need for instituting a church organization. In fact, such a project is openly discredited with such words as, "The temple for the worshippers of truth is spirit, not matter. No time was lost by our master in organizations, rites, and ceremonies, or in proselytizing for certain forms of belief." Yet, in 1879, in the mission's second evolutionary phase, it did become imperative to found a church organization, largely to act as an ark of safety for the newborn child, which was then starting to be under ferocious attack from an incensed carnal mind, daring to substitute mesmerism for for the pure reality of Christian Science, mind healing. Accordingly, the purpose of this initial church founding was to organize a church to commemorate the words and works of our Master, which should reinstate primitive Christianity and its lost element of healing. And that's in the manual, isn't it, on page 17. The church was to be called Church of Christ Scientist, and it had necessarily to be based on the demonstrations of Jesus, otherwise it would not be Christian Science. A point to bear in mind, therefore, is that it was incorporated under the law of the land. In other words, as Paul says of the mission of Jesus, that it was made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them that were under the law. Hence Mrs. Eddy was its sole administrator and pastor. And it worked in conjunction with the Massachusetts Metaphysical College organization chartered in 1881, of which Mrs. Eddy was likewise president and its only teacher. Now the college made teachers for the spread of Christian Science. And as the means in the third evolutionary phase of the mission, so please compare this with the third day of creation, of propagating the revelation far and wide. Teachers banded their students together into associations throughout the different American states, and these associations became in turn the bases of branch churches. So self-reproduction and self-propagation was the order of the day. Now, a general Christian Scientist Association had been formed back in 1875, the centennial day of the nation's founding, and this had led to a metaphysical college association being formed that consisted specifically of Mrs. Eddy's own students. Then, as the founding mission moved into its fourth evolutionary phase in 1886, it was realized, in accord with the fourth day of creation and its unitary interrelating principle, that Mrs. Eddy's own association and the associations of the growing army of qualified teachers should unite together on, in her words, an equal footing. And so what was called the National Christian Scientist Association was formed. And it was under the auspices of this new association that the convention took place in Chicago in 1888, at which Mrs. Eddy delivered her famous impromptu address, Science and the Senses. At which point, two opposite negative factors raised their heads simultaneously in the movement. One was the inordinate personal adulation of Mrs. Eddy herself in Chicago. The other was a state of rebellion against her authority that apparently arose back in Boston during her absence. Whereupon it became evident to her spiritual intuition that both organizations college and church would have to be dissolved and Christian Science put on a new, impersonal, principled basis where these personal and totally unscientific considerations would be unable to operate. Accordingly, at her last primary class teaching in 1889, Mrs. Eddy gave an address to the students on the dissolution of the walls of Jericho, when the Israelites all had to shout together in order that the walls might fall. She spoke also of the need for Christian Scientists, like the disciples of old on the day of Pentecost, to be of one mind. And therefore later that year she did two unprecedented and spiritually courageous things. She closed the college and dissolved the church. The Massachusetts Metaphysical College Association was resolved into what was called a voluntary assembly of Christians, and the National Christian Scientists Association into a voluntary universal assembly. You see, the accent now was on the word voluntary, as against the sense of authoritative compulsion. And to consolidate these enormous changes that were now taking place, Mrs. Eddy herself retired from all her public offices and returned to her home at Pleasant View in Concord, New Hampshire, for the much-needed purpose, as she saw it, of bringing forth another major revision of science and health. That is, of publishing in due course the famous 50th edition, which we talked about earlier. And the purpose behind it all, she declared, was in order to gain a higher hope for the race. Accordingly, she later wrote, and do let's listen to this very carefully, to gain a higher hope for the race, I closed my college. In the midst of unprecedented prosperity, and sought in solitude and silence a higher understanding of the absolute scientific unity which must exist between the teaching and letter of Christianity and the spirit of Christianity. She goes on to say, while revising science and health with key to the scriptures, the light and might of the divine concurrence of the spirit and the word appeared. Now, isn't that wonderful? Can we see how the teaching and letter of Christianity really pertains to the now closed college, and the spirit of Christianity to the now dissolved church? Because the light and might of the divine concurrence of the spirit and the word, the true spirit and the true letter, is soon to be represented in the new revision of the textbook by the inclusion in the chapter, the Apocalypse, of the Holy Four Square Mother City, with its emphasis on the marriage, the absolute scientific unity of what is called the Lamb and the Bride. Now, it's all of such tremendous spiritual importance that we really mustn't miss it, must we? You see, in line with this, she'd said at the time of dissolving the church, I recommended that the church be dissolved, telling how the votes were passed without a dissenting voice, the outcome being a great revival of spiritual mutual love, prosperity, and spiritual power. Just think of the need for that same state of affairs to be implemented today. And then came the words, adding to its ranks and influence, this spiritually organized, now had to be seen to be a spiritually organized, Church of Christ Scientists in Boston still goes on. A new light broke in upon it, and more beautiful became the garments of her who bringeth good tidings and publisheth peace. You see, the only thing that was really dissolved was a centralized, authoritarian concept of church. The church itself wasn't dissolved, but continued to progress in a new, spiritually organized form. Independent branch churches continued to be formed and to flourish, and teachers continued as before to hold their association meetings. With the result that for 3 whole years, from 1889 to 1892, while the textbook was in process of being revised, there was no centralized Church of Christ Scientists to be seen. Only individual, independent, self-governed branch churches. And this means that a situation was being exemplified as to what was rightly to take place eventually when the mother permanently left the human scene, and it wasn't just a matter of retiring temporarily from public office. And so can we see how, with regard to this first phase of church organization, Christian Science was literally being founded on the mission of Christ Jesus. You see, after the crucifixion and entombment, which runs parallel with the church's dissolution, there was no visible body of Jesus for 3 whole days. Then came the resurrection. In the case of Christian Science, at the end of 3 years, in 1892, the symbol of the Holy Mother City, having been put into the textbook in 1891, Mrs. Eddy reorganized the Church of Christ Scientist, giving it the specific name of the Mother Church. But was it really a different church? No. The dissolved church had been a mother church, but then the word was spelt with a little m. What appeared as the new mother church, spelt with a capital M, was the resurrected form of the first organization, which now, like the resurrected body of Jesus, was no longer subject to disintegration and death if its provisions were obeyed. The way this worked out practically was that, to Mrs. Eddy's delight and satisfaction, her statute was found amongst the laws of Massachusetts, making it possible to incorporate a body of donees, without materially organizing a church. Truly, said Mrs. Eddy, God's ways are not man's ways. All loyal Christian scientists will be pleased to know that we can have and hold church property without going back to outgrown forms of church organization. Whereas the first phase, therefore, was made under the law, the second phase, in that sense, wasn't. And therefore, in the words of Paul to the Galatians, what Christian scientists must not now be guilty of doing is turn again to the weak and beggarly elements of the law whereby they desire again to be in bondage. Because the church now is redeemed from under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons, to get the marvelous implication. And so again in Paul's words, it's the holy four-square city, the Jerusalem above, that is the key to the present situation, for it's this heavenly, universal city which is really, really the mother of us all. Therefore it is that this four-square mother city is itself the divine reality incorporated into the textbook in 1891, of which the Boston Mother Church, begun in 1892, is an essential teaching symbol that will in the end be translated by the reality which it symbolizes into the divine reality itself, just as was the case with the eventually translated or ascended body of Jesus. The difference between the two aspects is that the accent in the case of Jesus is on individual body, while in the case of Christian Science, what the church symbolizes is the generic body of mankind. We do see that, don't we? I do hope so. Now, to make all this possible in practical human terms, Mrs. Eddy was impelled to draw up two complementary legal documents. One legal in the sense of presenting the law of God, the other in the sense of being instituted under the law of the land. One called the Manual of the Mother Church, the First Church of Christ Scientist in Boston, Massachusetts, the other a deed of trust given to that body of donees referred to in the Massachusetts statute. Now these donees were four in number and known as the Christian Science Board of Directors. They were appointed to hold and administer the church's property and to be self-perpetuating under their own trust deed. In terms of the manual, however, they were not self-perpetuating, for Mary Baker Eddy's written authority was required for their appointment. And so whereas the first church phase, now dissolved, never had an edifice of its own, the second was designed to have its own church building. And whereas Mrs. Eddy was in a position to dissolve the first organization herself, the nature of the second is that it incorporates within it the seeds of its own self-dissolution, or rather its own self-translation, even as was the case with the resurrected body of Jesus. And to effect this translation, Mrs. Eddy, now styled its pastor emeritus, is under divine direction inspired to draw up in the rules and bylaws of the Mother Church manual a series of what are called estoppel clauses, demanding her own sanction, either verbally or in her own handwriting, for the election of certain church officers and for certain of the church's administrative functions. And these estoppel clauses she resolutely refused to change or delete, despite the dilemma she was told would ensue when she was no longer here if she didn't delete them. All of which means that when she's no longer at the helm to grant these sections, the church, as an outside ruling mother, ceases to function. And the Church of Christ Scientist will consist of independent, self-governing branch churches only, just as happened during those three exemplary years from 1889 to 1892. Well, the edifice is completed late in 1894 and dedicated early in 1895, by which time all personal preaching is done away with, and the holy impersonal word of the Bible and Science and Health is ordained by Mrs. Eddy to be the church's dual and impersonal pastor. So let's see that whereas the first church phase was founded necessarily on the word and works of our Master, which should reinstate primitive Christianity in its lost element of healing, what the second phase represented was Christian Science itself, once it had been so founded. That's to say, the second phase was designed to be built upon the rock Christ. Even the understanding and demonstration of divine truth, life and love, healing and saving the world from sin and death, thus to reflect in some degree the Church universal and triumphant. And that's the manual, page 19, isn't it? Hence Christian Science itself, in its immortal reality, pertains to no less than the world as a whole, based inexorably on the life work of Christ Jesus. And once the world understands spiritually and scientifically what Jesus accomplished in proving the nothingness of sin, disease, and death with regard to his own body, mankind itself, which in truth is the Christ body, will realize that it's already saved from death and mortality. Not vicariously, of course, but because to Jesus, consciousness, subjectively, and consciousness objectively, were one indivisible individual consciousness. And therefore he couldn't be proving the nothingness of death for himself without at the same time proving it on behalf of universal humanity. Now, are we happy about that? And so the symbolic Mother Church in Boston came divinely into being. And can you see, if you let your eye move across horizontally to the main center panel, how we're in the tone of life as spirit? Yes, where the original Christian Mother Church in Jerusalem is first established. Do we see that? Because returning to the year 1893, when the Boston Church is in process of being formed, an important world event taking place at this point is the first World's Parliament of Religions, held in Chicago, at which Christian Science is the only denomination actually invited to declare its doctrine to the assembled delegates, that is, to representatives of all the different religions of the world. Now see how beautifully this runs parallel with the opening topic of life as spirit in the center panel, when on the day of Pentecost the apostles voice the teachings of Jesus to devout men and women out of every nation under heaven who were assembled there in Jerusalem at the time. It's a beautiful example, you see, isn't it, of the parallels that exist ideationally throughout this whole panorama. When we read the triptych horizontally, in terms of its unfolding spiritual tones. Do you agree? You see, what matters is the consistency of the build-up of spiritual ideas, much more than the actual changing historical symbols whereby the ideas themselves are discerned and conveyed. So let's note now that as the complement of the newly organized church, the college too is reopened in 1899 in the form of a board of education, which Mrs. Eddy calls an auxiliary to her church. But isn't the letter rightly understood the auxiliary to the spirit? So it's as if letter and spirit, college and church, can no longer be construed as two separate functions, as they might have been before the dissolutions, but now are inseparably united, as they certainly are, in the Holy Mother City of the self-sacrificial Lamb and his worldwide body or bride. And so we come forward to 1901 and to the dawning of the 20th century. Referred to in the poem The New Century as Thou, God-crowned, patient century, thine hour hath come. Because this is indeed the century of man in the generic sense, in which, says the poem, love hath one race, one realm, one power. No wonder then the words that follow, dear God, how great, how good thou art to heal humanity's sore heart. And therefore this same year, 1901, Mrs. Eddy informs the world who her successor in leadership is to be, namely none other than man, in the image and likeness of the Father, Mother, God, man, the generic term for mankind. The man that is of the sixth day of creation, who has dominion over all the earth. Now there, because we're so near the end of side two of this sixth tape, I think it's a good place to pause and continue exactly at this point when we start on tape number 7.